Everybody, it's Congress.
Oh, hello, everyone.
Oh, are you starting?
No, it's Molly.
That's
Wood.
So funny.
I'm starting.
I didn't have the thing up. That's so funny. I was like, I just, oh my God.
He just hears the music and starts talking.
It's like
Pavlovian. Totally Pavlovian.
That's right.
Hey, Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Okay, whatever.
Hey, everyone. It's Molly Wood. Hi.
Sky Rosedahl. Hello.
Welcome to the show.
How are you?
Trained podcasting professionals here. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast about tech, the economy, and culture, where Kai and I try to make each other smarter. Hopefully you too try to figure out how to do the top of the show.
Well, you know, we get it right
basics.
Most of the time. That's what I'm saying.
Back to basics. That's what we're doing right now.
So, speaking of which, oh my goodness, the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There was a little bit of it. There's been a cycle. There's been a bell curve in my reaction to coronavirus, as I think you have all experienced in roughly real time on this podcast, which started, you know, early on. I'm hearing about it. It seems like it's going to be a thing. I'm freaking out. It looks like it's turning into more of a thing. I'm freaking out. Okay, I'm feeling bad about freaking out. I feel like I should really, you know, maintain some rational thought here and not freak out. Nope, I'm freaking out again.
Yeah.
And then, lo, these many weeks are later, we decided, hey, maybe we should do a show about this so that we can just actually understand some of the things that are happening.
And incredibly conveniently, global markets started freaking out as well, which means now that everybody is paying attention. I mean, it was 1,000 points yesterday, Monday. It's another, I'm looking at the screen right now, 485 on the Dow down today, Tuesday. And who knows where? Because this thing is spreading, people are using scary words like pandemic. The CDC is saying that Americans should prepare for an outbreak. That's the Centers for Disease Control, the government of the United States saying this. So we're going to talk about this for a little while.
And let's do the sort of just the facts thing. What we know is that there are almost 80,000 confirmed cases worldwide, that maybe 2,400 people have actually died so far. Over the weekend, we heard about outbreak hotspots in Korea, Italy, Iran. It is spreading. The World Health Organization has very specifically not labeled it as a pandemic yet. And in fact, I heard today mention that basically it's just the media who keeps trying to get them to do so. But part of the reason seems to be not wanting to incite panic. And so what we want to try to do today is understand pandemics writ large, where and when panic comes in and how that can skew things potentially, but also what we should be doing.
Yeah, for sure. So to do that, we have an expert on this podcast today. Her name is Olga Jonas. She's a senior fellow with the Harvard Global Health Institute, here to help us understand the risks, both economically and epidemiologically. I didn't say that word right, but all those other things. Olga, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Could I just ask you really quickly what your level of concern is right now?
Well, I'm very concerned, but that's because I've been studying this topic of, you know, pandemic and pandemic potential diseases and outbreaks and how we handle them as a global problem. And there are real weaknesses in the preparedness and in the way that these events are approached. So, yes, I'm worried. I'm scared. But it seems like now I'm not the only person scared anymore.
All right. So we have arrived at the same place, Olga. Are you concerned sort of equally about the actual spread of this illness and the reaction to it? Like, is there one of those things that you're more worried about? Or are you saying that our level of preparedness is going to prevent us from slowing the spread?
Yeah, I think you know, the actual illness, as I understand it, is that it's still very much under investigation, how serious a disease it is and how it is spreading and what sort of the potential is for damage to human health. But what is equally concerning is the way we react to the news of the disease. You know, like you mentioned that, you know, now there are 80,000 cases and 2,400 or more deaths that have been reported. And, you know, in the sort of bigger picture of global health, this is the toll from other diseases like diarrhea. And so, you know, what's the big deal? And the big deal is that, you know, it has the potential to spread further and to have people react to the news, not so much to the disease, but to sort of the perceived risk that they are facing in ways that end up being quite damaging to economy and to social cohesion. I think that's something we can do something about. We can't do anything about the virus. I mean, the virus is out there and it's what it is, right? Yeah. We should find out as much as we can about it. But we can definitely manage our handling of the outbreak and the spread, you know, to different countries much, much better.
All right. So you were at the World Bank for a while working on this kind of thing. And I want to ask you what we should be doing other than what we are doing, right? We're doing quarantines, flights have stopped, those kinds of things. What more should we be doing? And then what do you imagine I don't want to be materialistic about this, but it's gonna happen, right? What more should we be doing, and what will the costs to the global economy be?
Okay, so, you know, the public health measures that you mentioned, quarantines and, you know, limiting travel and testing people, I think some of them work better than others, and some of them may not work at all or be quite, you know, counterproductive in the end. So it's, yes, those measures are extremely important. And what we saw in China, the, you know, isolation of over 100 million people and restriction of their movement for weeks now is definitely something that, you know, could slow the spread. But is it going to stop it? It does not look like it. So what we should be doing is, you know, preparing ourselves that the disease is not going to be contained in China, which is already the case. And it seems to be quite transmissible, so it can infect 2 and 4 and 16, etc., in any place where it shows up. So what you need is much more preparedness to deal with the communications about what is happening, and much better understanding in the population what measures they can actually take to protect themselves. You know, the interesting thing we saw during avian flu, which was also a very scary episode, I don't know if you remember, H5N1 is the deadliest virus ever. There was a very vigorous campaign for, you know, washing hands, basic hygiene among the populations in, you know, the countries that were most affected, mostly in Southeast Asia, but also elsewhere. And what we saw is, you know, a reduction of diseases, reduction of diarrheal diseases. I mean, there was a big public health benefit to change behavior of people. You know, people will try to protect themselves if they are, I don't want to say scared enough, but, you know, informed enough about the risks that they face. And I think here the task of the public health authorities is to inform correctly about these risks. And I don't think that's happening. At least, you know, in this country, we see President Trump tweeting that everything is under control, and when it's not, because, you know, most people do not know what they would do if it arrives in their town, because, you know, nobody tells them. And that's really the task of the government, to ensure that, you know, the people are informed to take the measures to protect themselves, which will slow the spread also in the population.
Is this, from, you know, from your sort of historical perspective, we've heard that some of the techniques, many of the techniques we're deploying against COVID-19, this novel coronavirus, are almost the same as the ones we used for the 1918 Spanish flu. Like, is there anywhere where we have actually progressed in terms of preparedness and communication at all?
Well, I think risk communications has, you know, is a very interesting subject that is very well developed. And if you look at what Peter Sandman and Jody Leonard have been writing about, how to prepare, you know, populations for a pandemic and how to manage the fear in a way that, you know, does not have these secondary effects on that are very bad on the economy. So I think there's, you know, the knowledge is there. The problem is that it's not being used. I mean, at least in, you know, this instance. So, you know, as I mentioned, if you have high political leaders assuring the people that everything is under control, well, you know, that's the first sign of admitting that nobody's prepared. I mean, that the government is not prepared.
Yeah, well, so to that point, and I'm going to ask you to remember the financial crisis of 2008, when you had political leaders of both parties and in Congress and the White House agreeing on really controversial, but what proved to be economically essential remedies from the government to fix what had happened and mitigate the damage. Do you believe that we're in a position now where the government is equipped to do whatever it might take should this become a real problem?
Well, I think if it becomes the pandemic that, you know, we think is possible and probably increasingly likely, then the impact is similar to a severe recession. It's very sudden, and it's a, you know, it's a drop in aggregate demand, and also the supply chains that we have been hearing about. You know, there are disruptions in supply chains because of the disruptions in travel or in transportation. So once, you know, the modeling that we had done in 2008, 2009, about the impact is that it's comparable to a severe recession. And there, you know, the government is certainly well equipped to take the necessary counter-cyclical measures by, you know, monetary policy, increasing fiscal spending. And an interesting impact of pandemic is that it tends to affect businesses where people come face-to-face.
For sure.
And so... Right. And so you think, you know, restaurants, entertainment, barbershops, nail salons, all those kinds of services are provided by small businesses, right? It's mostly small business that doesn't have a cushion to ride something out for a few months. So you are going to see real hardship in the, you know, employment-intensive small business sector, probably, you know, in a country like the U.S. So there should be, you know, thinking already ahead what to do for these kinds of businesses on, you know, families depend on for their income. And if many of them are going bankrupt or you know, going out of unable to, you know, meet their bills, then, I mean, that's something for policy to address. And those kinds of preparations can be happening right now. Although it hasn't happened yet, you know, it has has not occurred yet. The idea is not to scramble at the last minute, but to anticipate the impacts. And, you know, it's not very difficult to anticipate that, you know, tourism industry and all the hospitality industry kind of things around it are going to be first and hardest hit. And then, you know, the impacts ripple through the economy to other sectors, of course. But you already know that there's going to be a very impoverishing impact on small business.
Olga Jonas is someone that you should listen to on this topic. Yeah. A senior fellow at the Harvard Global Health Institute, earlier worked at the World Bank for 33 years and coordinated the World Bank's operational responses to avian flu and pandemics. Olga, thank you so much for coming on.
Olga, thanks. It was great.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Great, except terrifying, you know.
Right, exactly. Great, except oh dear.
Yeah.
Well, I feel...
You feel a little vindicated?
Validated.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. I still need a hug. No, I think, I mean, look, at the point at which you're not even talking about the actual severity of the disease, you're talking about what people, like it's misunderstood.
Yeah.
For one thing, we don't know if we can trust the information coming out of China about it. And we know that almost every world government seems to be, I'm not even laying it only at the feet of the United States, almost every world government seems to be bungling the response.
Well, I mean, you think about that cruise ship in Japan and you're like, oh my God, right? The Diamond Princess and that whole thing.
Yeah. Right. You didn't even know it was happening, but you locked a bunch of people on a ship together.
Right. And now more of them got
sick. And then
sick,
let them go and then brought them back.
Right.
I mean, it's just, and so that is what, that's how you sort of get this like stair step to real concern. It's beyond just, and I think that's the important thing to acknowledge, it's beyond just the simple fact of the virus. It is how, it is the collective not smartness of humans.
Nice. Well done. Well done.
Thank you.
And Mollywood with the Real Dark Place. Join Molly in the Dark Place. Would you send us your thoughts about this or, frankly, anything else you like?
Please do.
Emails, voice memos, take your pick. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. We are coming back. Coming back. Back we are coming.
And we're back.
We are.
We told you. Listen, if you can count on one thing at a time, baby steps, everyone. Baby steps.
You know, it's funny. I listen to a bunch of other podcasts, actually, and I love it when they say, we'll be right back, and then the underwriting rolls. And I'm like, all right, you guys sitting there twiddling your thumbs, making dumb jokes, just like we do.
Uh-huh. What other podcasts do you listen to? Okay, write to us if you would like a list of recommendations from Kai. I want to know what podcasts you listen to.
You suck. Jesus.
I don't.
Oh, my God.
I know. That's why I engaged the crowd on this one, because I knew if it was just me, he would say no.
Oh, I'd totally blow you off. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I may yet blow off the crowd. We'll see.
Why? Are you embarrassed? Is it embarrassing?
Well, I mean, you know.
Is it like the one about The Bachelor?
It's not. It is so not the one about The Bachelor. Although I would say that a certain person whose name you're going to hear is the very last person in the credits on this podcast does listen to The Bachelor podcast. Yes. Doesn't watch the show somehow, I think, but listens to the podcast. Whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whatever. Who's going first? You?
Okay.
Me?
News fix. Yours. You're listed first.
All right. Olga stole mine a little bit, but I have to read this. It is a tweet from the President of the United States yesterday as the markets were melting down and people were starting to get very, very nervous. The President of the United States said this. The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA. We are in contact with everyone and all relevant countries. CDC and World Health have been working hard and very smart. Stock market is starting to look very good to me. So a couple of things. Number one, I truly don't understand how he can tweet some of these things that he tweets, because they're demonstrably not true. I would, however, just in my guise as a business and economic journalist, like to point out that on days like this, in times like these, do not check your 401k. Do not rebalance your portfolio. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Just watch things. Keep an eye on things. Be attentive. Figure out where your limits are. But on a day when the Dow falls 3% is not the time to sell off the kids' college fund. It's just not. Okay? That's it. That's my public service journalism for the day. President of the United States notwithstanding.
Well, maybe he means someone actually tweeted me. Thanks for listening so closely to the show, friends.
Yes.
Big sale at the stock store.
Yes, absolutely. Look, it was on dips like this, it's a buying opportunity. But
some cash reserves, it's a buying opportunity. But maybe that's what he meant, but we'll never know.
And it's not a buying opportunity for everybody, right? I mean, come on.
No, I mean, and that's an absurd assumption. Like I say it all the time, but what is it? There's only some incredibly small percent, and that's sort of why, in a way, this is galling, even if that's what it means, because an incredibly small percent of individuals invest in the stock market in that way.
Yep.
Or just like, oh, it's a shopping day. I mean, I make a lot of jokes about it, but like, I'm not going shopping at the stock store. Like, come on. It's just a fun thing to say.
Yeah.
Yes, as responses go in a way that, you know, may or may not reassure people, that was not helpful.
Not a great one.
I am fascinated. Well, two things. One specifically.
Yes.
I have two things, Kai.
All right. Yeah, that's fine.
Them.
Look, I read the tweets as well and the notes, and people want more of us opining about the news. I get that.
So there you go. Luckily, because I can't stop. Well, no, this was fascinating. One weird-ish, silver-ish lining was a tweet the other day noting that the coronavirus fallout has wiped about 25% of China's CO2 emissions. Wiped them out over the past 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that will actually potentially reduce annual emissions by something like 1%. And I've been getting all these. I don't think that this is our new strategy by any means, to be clear.
Good. Yes.
But it is very interesting because it's led to all these pitches about like, well, working from home is going to be the new reality and that's going to reduce all these transportation emissions. And
yeah, look, the recession did the same thing, right? The recession did the same exact thing.
Humans find a way to like, I don't know, either see the good or,
is this our new happy place? Thing. Is that the happy place thing?
Oh, fascinating. And then the science thing that is vaguely happy place that I'm super fascinated by is that MIT researchers announced yesterday that they have used machine learning and artificial intelligence to figure out how to isolate an antibiotic drug that is more effective than almost anything they've ever found before and has cured several completely otherwise antibiotic resistant diseases in mice. And it's like so interesting. I can hear you formulating a dark place. I can literally hear it.
Did you hear me open my mouth? I went.
I did.
Yeah.
Jizzy made like a little tiny ASMR sound and I was like, here it comes. And he's going to be like, but you're creating even more super.
Oh my God.
This is a good time to remind people that we are in fact 400 miles away, Kai and I.
And yet we are inside each other's heads.
You can just see it.
Oh my God.
You just see it coming.
That was pretty funny.
But it's super interesting. Like they're able to use machine learning algorithms to like just swipe on through millions and millions of potential molecules and come up with like drug discovery way faster than has ever been possible before.
What could possibly go wrong?
Your turn. Exactly.
That's it. I'm done. I'm out with that one. That's it.
And also if you wanted to engineer a superbug.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Totally cool, interesting, lots of promise.
Maybe we went from silver lining to like coal lining. That's right. This was a really good story with a
Ashes
coal lining.
Mouth. All right. I believe that is it for the news fix, but we do this thing weekly. It's called a newsletter. Go sign up for it at marketplace.org/newsletters. It's really good.
Yes. Definitely. Yes. And this would be a good note. Speaking of newsletters, our newsletter author, Erica Phillips, slacked us and was like, hey, but everyone should still wash their hands and use antibiotics correctly, though, which is true.
Yeah. Which is true. Did we not? Oh, well, yes.
Just
yes,
quick note.
Yes. Consult your own medical professional. But yes, wash your hands and use
wash
drugs
your hands.
As prescribed.
Don't touch your face.
Yes.
Time for the mailbag.
Okay.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So last week we talked about the housing crisis with Connor Daugherty. You remember that one? It was a good chat. Big part of the conversation revolved. God, you know, it's amazing. I get paid to speak this language and I have such difficulty doing it sometimes. around the often problematic relationship between developers and local government. So, obviously, the key way to address a housing crisis is to build more housing. But when people try to do that, there is pushback from the people who live nearby saying, not in my backyard. Here's a comment from Leonard Leichnitz. He's a housing developer. Here's what he had to say.
Kai and Molly, thanks for your housing series and particularly your interview with Connor Daugherty. As a builder-developer, I frequently think about how biased the political system is against new housing. Connor rightly observed that people generally oppose new housing built near them, so they elect representatives with that perspective. I've sat through countless hearings where resident after resident threatens that if the council members vote in favor of a project, the resident will work to remove them from office. This local government dynamic will never change. After a lifetime in housing, I believe that if we are going to address California's housing deficit and the concomitant homelessness and affordability issues, the state must take away the veto power of local government over new housing. Thanks for paying attention to this important issue.
Whoa. I mean, okay, yes, I get your point, but taking away power from local government, I don't know. That's in part, well, whatever.
Well, that's what SB 50 would have done.
Yeah, I know. And it failed.
I mean, that was
right?
a big I mean, part you know. Of our... Right. But that was a big part of our conversation with Connor was this idea that maybe that is actually what has to happen because you cannot solve a problem at national scale. Can you? Can you solve a problem with the national scale, like city by city, county by county?
Right. Let's work state scale here, right? And if you read California news at all, you know that Governor Newsom last week maybe did his State of the State address and said like 3 minutes of platitudes up top and then spent like 37 minutes talking about homelessness and the housing crisis in the state of California. And I think there's a certain amount of put up or shut up now on the governor to deliver on this hugely important issue for this state and eventually the country. And honestly, I don't know if he's got the oomph.
Well, that was, in fact, a totally thankless task because it caused people like you and me to go, great, maybe you should do something about it, and probably caused him to go, yeah, I would love to do that if I could take away the veto power of local government over new housing.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that is a big part of this discussion, and that is in no way close to being solved, but does have to be seriously discussed. Also, just want to congratulate Leonard real quick on concomitant.
Yes.
Good vocabulary word.
It's a good word.
At the end of last week's show, I asked you to tell us where you listen to the podcast, and you did.
Man,
a great. Ton of you wrote in, which is really fun. And we're just going to like lightning round through a couple of those responses. Boom, boom, boom. And starting with like my new favorite person, Katie Lacewell, who whose name is perfect for her answer. Katie from St. Louis listens while spinning wool into yarn with her dog at her side. Life goals.
Wesley Friel listens 70% in the car, 30% with a glass of wine while cooking. A ton of you, by the way, say you listen in the car or during your commute. No surprise really at all.
Yes, but among those who do not, Mike Thompson listens while washing baby bottles, and he even sent us a photo, just a dude by the sink with his AirPods on, washing baby bottles. And then listener Jasmine Robinson wrote, I'm sure people like hike Everest or run marathons while listening, but thanks for making me smart while I do chores.
There you go. Mike Milius listens while inspecting aircraft gearboxes. He works for Collins Aerospace. They're out of West Palm Beach, Florida.
Carl Ekstrom listens from Stockholm, Sweden. Where it's presumably cold and snowy.
Yes.
But Dylan E. listens from Bali, the islands of the gods, as he calls it, where it is presumably not cold and snowy.
Married couple named Fran and Brent wrote in to say, we save your podcast for our very frequent drives from Colorado to Laramie, Wyoming, to visit our son at university there. It makes our otherwise mundane drive something to look forward to, and it keeps us from fighting. Also, those are huge distances people drive out west, I'm telling you. Up there somewhere.
I know. I was actually, I was really appreciating this because I was like, oh yeah, that's totally the kind of thing you'd do. And you'd go like, yeah, that one's a little far.
Yep.
And then this might be the best. Henry Moorman writes and says, I listen to Make Me Smart primarily while playing pinball.
Wow.
Last year, goes Henry, I became a competitive pinball player, which means I compete in pinball leagues and various tournaments around St. Louis, and sometimes I even win money. Are you allowed to listen to a podcast while competing, or is this during practice?
But how do you hear it over all the bings and the bongs?
Right? So many questions.
Yeah.
We need more bings and bongs in our show, I think, now. Pinball.
Oh, my God. How about that?
Henry wins for now.
All right, one more. It comes from Jim French, and it segues nicely back into the housing conversation. Here's what he says. I typically listen on my commute to San Francisco from the Rock Ridge BART station. BART is the mass transit subway system in San Francisco Bay Area. And he says it passes through the MacArthur station. This morning, I arrived at both of those places eerily in sync with Connor Daugherty's mention of them. The 19-story Rock Ridge building Mr. Daugherty mentioned, if built, would become the view from our bedroom window. I am not thrilled with this notion or the thought of having a multi-year construction site outside our window, but I enthusiastically support housing construction in our region. So go ahead and build. Just please price the units suitably and please design a building at least a little more attractive than the one at MacArthur. I'm lucky to live in a city I love, he writes, but nobody is entitled to a world without change. Which is
That's a great line.
Yeah.
And when Connor said that on the podcast about the MacArthur one, I mean, this is hyper-local right now, but I was like, oh, I've been that person who was like, but it's so ugly. That does raise, though, I have a friend who does sort of architectural restoration work and who's very familiar with building and zoning laws. And one thing that is notable is that cities, especially Oakland, are not great at actually directing development in the places that can support that development. So, for example, we built this like really ugly building across from MacArthur BART, which makes a lot of sense. It's a transit hub, and that was really smart. But we have tons of land, and I'm sure that this is the story in so many other cities, tons of space, including space for cars and parking and driving and traffic, by this area called Jack London Square around the waterfront, which is also close to BART and ferries. And that there could be zoning and development efforts that actually say, we want you to build here, and that that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Like literally that level of coordination in cities doesn't always exist. And so you have things just popping up willy-nilly. And then the city says, oh, well, you would like to build a whole bunch of apartment buildings? Okay, go ahead, wherever you want.
Yes.
Which also doesn't make sense. Like there is a universe in which nobody's entitled to a world without change, but at least the change is managed and intelligent.
Right. I'm going to circle back to Gavin Newsom and our housing developers note. Part of what happens, and this applies with so many things in this society right now, part of what's lacking in getting this done is political courage, right? And what has to happen is politicians being willing to use the power they have for as long as they have the power, and then be okay with not having power anymore, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Have I met politicians? Yes, I have.
I like it, though.
All right.
All right. Before we go, let's look on the upside. Let's like get a little more positive. Here's this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which comes from listener Steph Courtney.
Hello, Kai and Molly. This is Steph. My answer to the Make Me Smart question is that I used to think that truth came only from numbers. I think this is probably a shared misconception. I was raised very much on science, which is great, wonderful, but started to figure out at some point that maybe there is more going on. Maybe more was true than just what, you know, perhaps public radio reported from traditional science. Despite my liberal arts degree, it wasn't until halfway through my master's that I took a social science class and was taught that other people knew this for sure. There's such thing as qualitative data and other ways of knowing. This should have made sense to me as I have, you know, at least a full geology field notebook of not just numbers, but descriptions and pictures and all the qualities that science and life in the natural world can have. But long story short, just because you can assign a number to something doesn't make it meaningful. And there's so much more that we can know from basically everything else there is in the world beyond just numbers. I hope to apply this knowledge in the rest of my PhD and do better science with it, hopefully. Thanks. Love the show.
Yes, context is everything. Amen.
Yes, that is like the perfect right. Make Me Smart right. answer for, right. I don't know, everything that we try to yep. do at Marketplace every day.
Yep.
Love it.
For sure.
Better science with yep. feelings.
There you go.
All right, that's it for this week's podcast. Don't forget about our daily Smart Speaker Explainers. Though, in today's edition, I tell you all about the history of bubble wrap. I mean, I'm just saying.
I'm tuned into that one.
It's just a little snackety fun.
I'll just do it for everybody right now.
Interesting information.
Ready? Alexa, make me smart. All right, there we go. Everybody's playing.
You're welcome.
Right now. There we go. I gotta go home and do that.
That was just like a straight up rebellion.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our video intern, Ethan Peretz. He of the best name in the house right now. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips, who would remind you one more time yep. to wash your hands.
Yes, and take your drugs as prescribed. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Ben Holiday. We need to reach out to him, by the way, and see if his real name is Benjamin. I'd like to check on that, please.
Good idea.
And Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Let's remember what podcast she listens to, people. Also, one more thing. The guy with the amazing voice who sang Happy Birthday after the credits last week, that was Oluse Banjo. He works at the front desk at our LA offices.
It's possible that my questions will be so incoherent that you will not be able to answer them, but I'll do my best. No, I'm kidding. No. I don't know what's wrong with me today. We're going to be fine. I am rolling.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.